Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up on today's program, WISO Music Director Nikki Dakota has a conversation with Yellow Springs filmmaker Julia Reichert. She is the subject of a national touring exhibit featuring her work over the last 50 years. Don't miss it. We've also got Dayton Youth Radio coming up first. Inside a large teal and tan building on Troy Street in Dayton, as I'm about to find out, there's a lot that goes on. I'm here to meet Monty Bush, a former police officer and the founder of Victory Project, which is a privately funded, faith-based after-school program for boys and young men in Montgomery County. I've known about the Victory Project for a few years now and glad for this chance to come here and find out more about the organization.
Good, how are you?
Pretty good.
Thank you.
Inside, Monty introduces me to two young men who will give me a tour of the VP facility, 13-year-old Jeremy Hemming and 15-year-old Devontae Hatch.
So this is the kitchen. It's open kitchen for all the guys until after dinner. And dinner is at 6 p.m. every night, and guests bring in food.
For the next 20 minutes or so, Jeremy and Devontae show me around what is essentially one of the coolest clubhouses a boy could have access to. Beyond the large kitchen and dining room areas are a rec room with some pretty cool graffiti on the walls.
Yeah, so this is the rec area where you can play video games. You can play ping pong, pool, as one of our students is doing right now. And that's over there is a freezer, so I put some frozen stuff in there. Or put like a drink in there if you want to. Mm-hmm. And you could just like, this is another chill spot. You could just hang out. You could take
from the rec room, we move into another large area filled with lockers, weight benches, and other sports equipment. Beyond that, through another door, a dozen or so young men are playing basketball.
Usually we play 4-on-4 as a team. And we had a basketball team. We had a basketball team. We played for the Kingdom. And this is where we'll practice at, or we'll practice.
Stepping away from the spirited game, we head upstairs where it's a bit quieter. Several boys are studying while others pass through on their way to other parts of the building. Throughout the tour, Jeremy and Devontae tell me what it's like to be a part of Victory Project.
This is called the Great Room, where we have three couches where students can sit, be on their phones. Sometimes we learn what we're doing for the day. To your left is the worship room.
As they take me back to the office for my talk with VP founder Monty Bush, I think of how impressed I am with their conduct and communication skills. During my interview with Monty, he breaks down Victory Project's mission and how it all got started.
Well, Victory Project is an alternative street to America's youth, and what that means is we're looking to take guys who are typically disengaged, and then what that means is when they leave school every day, they're not going to play sports, not playing any extracurricular activities. They're basically going home to an area or a neighborhood that doesn't have a lot of opportunities. And we're looking to fill that time with educational, employment, and faith-based activities.
Typically, how many kids go through your program each year, or how many involved in the program right now?
We typically go through about 50 students a year. The average stay is 9 to 12 months for a guy. Some guys stay a lot longer. And we have 35 right now with some recruits, and we have some openings so the guys can – it's pretty much an ongoing waiting list, but we get to that list pretty regularly, so there's not too long of a list wait, we hope.
Obviously, you hope to grow the organization.
That's right, and that's kind of where we're at right now is trying to – with scalability, without losing the family and close-knit feeling that we have here. We've cultivated that. Without losing that, but we definitely see opportunities to grow into the neighborhoods because transportation is one of the big barriers for young people and just people in the inner city in general. And the quicker we can or closer we can bring the services to them, the better.
We've got two of your young men here with us. We had like 10 to 12 downstairs playing basketball, another two, I think, working together on a computer. I'm sure the numbers vary each night as to who shows up to participate in the program.
That's right. There's a membership process to become a member of VP, and once they're a member, they get their own door code so they can come in the facility during business hours. And we have certain classes they have to attend throughout the week, and then otherwise they have a lot of flexibility to just come. You know, this is their place to hang out, have recreation, participate in programming, have access to food on a regular basis, and creating that consistency that's really not in many of our homes, you know, the consistency of services and food and things like that that we're trying to create for them. So like tonight we had about 23 students here, 24 students, and we had other students doing other things, but we typically, it's like mid-20s to mid-30s.
If the kids are given their door codes and given a little bit of kind of input into kind of what direction they want to take, this has to be a great opportunity for kids, and you're putting a lot of trust in them. That has to mean something to them as well.
Yeah, I think so. There's a Booker T. Washington is one of my favorite authors, and he has a saying that the biggest help you can give somebody is give them responsibility and then let them know you trust them. And that really builds that character of, hey, I have something that's valuable here because I've been trusted with it. And we're rarely let down, rarely. These young men, meet and exceed expectations on a regular basis. And we always say, like, this stuff is already inside them. You know, this character is there. We're just helping undo some barriers that's keeping them from experiencing that. And that comes through some of our faith-based activities. But it's a lot just being that consistency of services. And we say that authenticity, consistency, and proximity creates opportunity. So if we're authentic, we're consistent in messaging, we're working close proximity with them, which we're with them 6 days a week, year round, we will earn the right to be heard. And we apply a lot of love and accountability here. We love you enough to hold you accountable, and we have to earn that.
Let's talk about your biggest challenges running a program like this. With many nonprofits, it comes down to funding. So let's talk about that and any other challenge that you have in front of you.
You're exactly right, Jerry. It is definitely funding for scalability for us. We don't take government funding, so we do a lot of our own fundraising with private foundations or individuals. We have businesses participation. We have foundational grants, private grants. But that's our barrier. Financially, we want to grow. We see the capacity to grow, but we're trying to increase our income to allow that. And so we have a fundraiser coming up on October 16th called Beating the Odds Breakfast here in Dayton at Sinclair. That's our major fundraiser. And then we have fundraising opportunities throughout the year. We sell T-shirts and do other kind of things like that. And I think that's our major fund. That's a major barrier. And it's also finding folks who can volunteer with us. That's always a need. You know, volunteering is, you know, time is the only thing is more valuable than money. And people are very busy. They have a lot of things they're doing. And we're here so much that we can usually find an opportunity to get involved because we're here 6 days a week, year round, to 8 o'clock at night. There's usually a slot or two available that can fit most people's schedule.
You are founder and CEO. What drove you to found an organization like this and in the day-to-day activities? And some of your program directors, too, I want to know, what do you think drives them to let these kids in and be a part of their daily lives?
Yeah, that's a great question. It kind of started back when I was a police officer. I was a cop for 15 years, and I found myself being called to homes to deal with things that my mom dealt with my dad. Mom would call my dad at work, and he would handle it when he got home. I found myself being called to homes by, you know, like single mothers and grandparents trying to raise teenage boys, and they didn't have that support there for whatever reason. And so I always felt that's not right, you know, because I found these kids graduating from disciplinary things at home to real criminal activity. And I knew there had to be some kind of mediator there. And as a Christian, I thought the church had a bigger role to play, but it was just a way for me to have somebody else do it. I mean, it's not me. It can't be me. I don't have the expertise and all these things. But over time, my faith and my family really encouraged the opportunity to start Victory Project. And a lot of the research and development period that we did, one of the biggest things that helped us was we spent time with other nonprofits. But really what was the biggest help was I spent time with kids that were locked up. And I'd say, I'd just tell them, hey, I'm starting a program. This is what I'm trying to do. Can you help me? You know, what are you going to do when you get out of here? And they'd say, well, I'm not coming back here again. I want to find a job. I want to do better in school. I'm going to start helping my mom. I want to find a new group of friends. And I knew from my experience that you're going to go home to the same neighborhood, same lack of opportunities, and that good intention is going to last about 6 months maybe, and you'll find yourself back in that into the system. So, and then talking to parents, you know, single moms working two jobs, trying to go back to school, grandmother, whatever the case may be, what would help you? And they would say, I'm doing all these extra things just to survive. I'm not sure where he is when he comes home from school because I'm out working or whatever. So they were looking for that, an alternative to the system, as much as the kids were looking alternative to the street. And so based on their experience and what they gave us back, plus what I thought and talking to other experts, we created the program based on the need.
That need is incredible when you look at the nation as a whole. And you've mentioned that you want to expand the program. I would think that can't happen fast enough for you, even though I'm pretty sure all of this just takes up most of your day.
Yeah, it does. And I've got great, you know, great staff. And you, to answer the question before of what brings them here, and it's, you know, it's a calling. You know, a lot of it's a calling into this field because you don't make any money. We don't have benefits. I mean, it's a really, and we work crazy hours. We're open every holiday but Christmas because the streets don't close. So we got to be available. So it's really got to be a calling. And, you know, most of the staff will say it's the interaction with the kids is what keeps them coming back. You know, they see these young men choosing to be here. So they bless us, you know, more than we are influencing them. I'm sure that's the case for most staff. And it's a total commitment. I'm financially committed. My family's committed. You got to be all in this kind of role. And I've never regretted it, you know, in the past 10 years. It's been a blessing to me and my family. So it's just a labor of love. You've heard that before, but it's, you know, it's true. And when you spend time with the kids and you see graduates come back and they're sharing their successes and they give us lots of credit, but I'll tell them, you know, God's had a plan for you and now we're seeing that develop and it's just great to be a part of their lives. So it's cliche, but it's, you know, it's accurate.
Victory Project founder and CEO Monty Bush. The Victory Project's Beating the Odds Breakfast, an annual gathering to celebrate all that has happened in the previous year and to fundraise for continued success for the organization, will take place on Wednesday, October 16th, 8 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. at Sinclair Community College. That's Building 12 in the Ponet Center. And you can find out more about this organization, maybe choose to volunteer, at victoryproject.org. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend. Today on Dayton Youth Radio, we'll meet DeLaron Daniels, a junior from Thurgood Marshall STEM High School, and hear an interview he did with his grandpa Jim, an African-American veteran from World War II.
Grandpa, what year did you enlist in the Army?
They called you in. You didn't enlist that time. They called you in. That was in 1943. Like I say, it was pretty hard. It's pretty hard. It wasn't easy when you're around 18 years old. So I'm 94 years old now.
What was it like being in the war?
It was a hard job, hard and dangerous. Wasn't easy.
My grandfather's name is Jim Guy. He's not my biological grandfather. He became my grandfather when he adopted me and my older brother, Dalen, as his grandchildren. He was one of the first people to hold me at the hospital after I was born. I had did this interview with my grandfather, and it was pretty amazing what he was telling me. Like, he told me how dangerous it was and how risky it was.
And on the ship, you're loading and unloading live ammunition, so that was dangerous. That stuff could blow up any time on you. So that was dangerous also. And we stayed in our little pup tents, like the Boy Scouts had. And at nighttime, the Japanese, they'd be shooting all around you and everything like that, you know, shooting over the tents like that.
How did you feel about the Japanese?
About the Japanese?
Yeah.
They were just like the Americans. They had to do what they had to do, I guess. They had their orders, and just like the American people had their orders. So you couldn't blame the guys out there fighting much, because there was young guys out there fighting too, so they didn't come on their own. They was ordered to go, you know, like that.
He told me a lot about what happened. He said that I remind him of his brother. He told me that his brother was gunned down during the war. What is the most intense memory that you have of the war?
We went to the Philippines, so that's why they're still fighting in the Philippines. And it was, we had to stay on the ship, and it was dead people floating all around in the water out there. And then, too, we had to stay on the ship to get the beach cleaned off, because they had the mines on there. If you step on one of them, it'd blow you up, you know, like that.
He's brown-skinned, and he's very smart. Even when he was younger, he never smoked. He has light brown eyes, and he's bald and walks with a cane. And he also used to make the best chicken I've ever had in my life. Like, it was perfect. My favorite memory of him was when I was 14 years old. That whole week, we were just passing time and creating memories.
Well,
Why did you enjoy sharing your military stories with me when I was younger? I was thinking about joining the Army myself.
I think you might have something to think about when you ever go in there.
Did you get the GI Bill to go to school?
Oh, no. Well, black people, it's hard to get anything like that. I tried to get it, but I never could get it.
I would like to say thank you, Grandpa Jim, for telling me your stories and for answering my question. And
okay. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And I love you. I was 14 years old the last time I spoke to him in person in Dayton, Ohio, before he moved to Texas. I didn't know he had moved until after school one day, and my mom told me that he was moving away because he kept getting sick and there wasn't anybody else to take care of him. You have amazing people in your life. Just because they're old, that doesn't mean you could look down upon them, you know what I'm saying? Because they have done great things before you were even born. They're important people in your life. There are not many black World War II veterans still alive to this day. For Dayton Youth Radio at Thurgood Marshall, this is Dale Rondales.
That story was called The Last Detail, produced by Dale Rondales from Thurgood Marshall STEM School. Special thanks to Nathan Shields. De La Ron's Grandpa Jim and thousands of black veterans who fought in World War II were denied the promised housing and educational benefits that came with the GI Bill. You can learn more about this story by visiting our website, wyso.org. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basine Blunt.
Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation, Ohio Arts Council, and the Veteran Foundation. Well, on Wednesday evening in Columbus, a special exhibit opened that features the 50-year career of Yellow Springs filmmaker Julia Reichert. The Wexner exhibit is actually one stop on a national tour highlighting Reichert's work, which has focused on a variety of era-defining issues of the human experience. This week, before the Wexner exhibit opening, Reichert was a guest on WISO's Excursions with host and music director Nikki Dakota. In the interview, Reichert discusses the arc of her career as an Antioch College student with little to no knowledge of filmmaking to an accomplished Emmy-winning, Academy Award-nominated documentarian.
Julia Reichert, 50 years in film. Welcome and thank you for coming today.
Well, thank you, Nikki. Always great to be here.
You must feel right at home.
Yes.
You came to us. You're not originally from this area, but you came to Antioch College, and I believe you graduated in 1970.
Right.
And the very next year, you made a film that really sort of changed the face of our understanding of feminism in the United States and the feminist movement. That was called Growing Up Female, released back in 1971. People still make reference to this film. But before that, your very first media expression was on WYSO.
It was. It was right here. Of course, the studio looked really, really different back then. It was not at all the same studio. It was way, like, one-tenth the size. And, of course, the walls were covered with egg crates. I mean, this
actual
egg crates, which absorb sound apparently really well and are very inexpensive. So, yeah, I was on the air, and I had shows, and I learned the wonderful thing about WISO back then, and it was pretty much a student station. The students kind of took it over, you know, as students did back then in the late 60s. But that's where I learned how to interview, how to cut tape, how to edit, how to mix music, how to tell a story, how to tell a story with a beginning, middle, and end. You know, and all of this could be learned here at WISO for no money.
Right.
It isn't like you had to have film stock and expensive cameras and fancy tape recorders or any of that. You could just do it. And I actually really loved cutting tape back then. Have you ever done that?
You know, I started in 1990 and cutting tape was done.
It was already done. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But I've seen the reel-to-reels with that little thing at the bottom. You pull it down and it's got the 45-degree angle and a razor blade nearby. That's
right.
How you edited.
That's exactly
crazy.
Right. And you hung up the little strips of tape, right? And then put them together in the order you felt was best. Yeah, that was, Yeah, that's how I started. We did that for many years. Anyway, it was a wonderful, wonderful time to be at WYSO back then.
A lot of notable folk.
And that was the beginning, yeah. And I used all those sound skills when we made Growing Up Female, because actually we had so little film footage because it was so expensive to buy film stock back then from Kodak. Very, very expensive. So we really had what is called a 2-to-1 ratio, right? Which is a tiny little ratio. In other words, so, most of what we shot is actually in the film.
So for every 2 hours, you got 1 hour of
finished
film.
So that means a lot of sound
and
editing.
The film's 52 minutes.
52 minutes, yeah. Uh-huh. So we shot about 100 minutes of film. And so that's why a lot of it, if people see it again, a lot of it is voice over from documentary audio. So those skills that Jim Klein and I developed at WYSO, Jim Klein being my partner on that film, came in extremely handy when we were making a very low budget film back then, Growing Up Female. And that was actually my senior project.
Wow.
That was my senior project. So if any students listening out there, you could make a film for your senior project. We did. We didn't even know how to do it. We just kind of figured it out, Aniokian style.
Oh, how lucky.
Yeah.
So you were born and raised in New Jersey.
Yep.
Came here to go to college. Ended up with your senior project being sort of like your trampoline jump into a career that now 50 years later, we have occasion to look back on in a retrospective. This got underway, an entity called Chicken and Egg, and they through the Wexner Center, who contacted the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, and all together this became culminated. They just finished. Did you call this an exhibit, or is this a – will these films be playing? Can you go sit and watch these films?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that's
cool. They'll be – and they have a beautiful theater there at the Wexner Center, and the ticket price is not very much. I forget what it is, but it's way less than a mall theater. And it has quite a few pictures from WYSO back in those days.
I can't wait. It also
has pictures of the kind of equipment we used back then – for the camera equipment, the sound equipment, which is huge and bulky and so forth.
Wow.
So it has that. And it kind of walks through all the films.
Ten of them, beginning in 1971.
I think something like 10. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 10 films are in the retrospective. The first four are on 16 millimeter, which, of course, people don't use anymore.
Right.
Were made right around here with my partner, Jim Klein. And the next, I guess, four or five were made on digital. By then we had jumped into the digital age,
mm-hmm.
were made on digital. And they were also, a lot of them made around here with my partner, Steve Bognar. So all these films are going to be seen at the Wexner Center throughout October. And I don't have all the exact dates in front of me, but each of them is followed by some kind of discussion, often with me or me and Steve or me and Jim. And at the Wexner Center, what is their website? It's something like
wexarts.org. W-E-X as in Wexner, wexarts.org.
Yeah, that's where people can find out. All the films are being shown. And that's the exciting thing to me, is having the retrospective. I mean, it's nice to get honored as a person, but what's really wonderful is that the films are getting rediscovered, right? This is traveling all across the country. The Museum of Modern Art was the first step. Now it's the Wexner Center, but then it's going to
all over the place. Wisconsin, Cleveland Institute of Art, Portland, Oregon, Louisville, Kentucky, Minneapolis, Houston, Silver Spring, Maryland, and finally ending this coming May and June at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. So
yeah.
A year's worth.
A year's worth. And actually UCLA, Los Angeles also.
Oh.
That might have been added after that was written. But anyway, it's pretty amazing to see – to sit in with an audience seeing a film like Seeing Red or Union Maids, which is even earlier, people who were not even around when the films were made, and seeing people just be captivated and have so many questions. To have those films rediscovered is really what's exciting about the retrospective. They do give, you know, they're slices of American history. They're slices of a time. And they're true slices of a time. We take a long time to make our films, Right. Mm. It takes a long time to find the truth sometimes. Truth takes time. And sometimes we invest 6, 7, 8 years in a film to really get it right, to really know we're telling the true story. So these are really like slices of our culture over time. Like one I would mention, because it was totally made in Dayton, is called Methadone, An American Way of Dealing. So we're now having a big crisis with heroin.
Deja vu.
Yeah. And this was the big crisis that we had in the 70s. It's a very different kind of audience, population that was affected then. And the methods of trying to cope with that were very different. And we spent months in this methadone clinic before we even brought a camera in.
Wow.
You know, like getting to know people. You know, we were entering into a different culture, me and Jim. You know, we were kids a couple of years out of college, Antioch College. But we decided to make this film, and we would just drive there and hang out and get to know people. In the last month, we brought in our camera person, who was also an Antioch student, actually Alicia Weber. She was really good. So that gives you an insight into, like, who were affected in that earlier heroin epidemic, even that there was an earlier epidemic of heroin in Dayton and all over the country.
And I found out this last round, our per capita, the highest in the country, again. It's like the worst kind of deja vu.
I know. Dayton has been always very hard hit.
Yeah.
I think it's because we're a largely like working class town, or we certainly were, and now we're almost like an ex-working class town, which has sent a lot of people to, you know, get painkillers and so on.
I love that you say we. Methadone was out in 1974. By the time Union Maids was released in 1976, it was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. So your third film out.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so I think of that and how this Julia Reichert, 50 years in film, will travel across the country.
Mm-hmm.
I marvel at that you stay in Dayton, that you could go anywhere. Mm-hmm. You're not even from here, but you, since you came here, have made this your home. Why do you stay in Dayton?
Well, you know, I really like Dayton. I mean, it's home. I mean, now I live in Yellow Springs. I lived in Dayton for a long time, and I love Yellow Springs, and I love Dayton. Well, there's probably a few reasons. One is I like living among regular people. You know, if I lived in New York or L.A. or San Francisco, my friends who I hung out with would be other filmmakers, people in the arts, let's say, the people I went to dinner with and hung out with or whatever. And there's some of that here.
Sure.
But overall, you know, like my one neighbor is a high school teacher. Another neighbor works at the post office. You know, another neighbor is a contractor. Just regular folks. And when we want to have screenings of our films as works in progress, which we do a lot, I might have even invited you, Nikki, to one or more of them. It's just, you know, you get feedback from not other filmmakers and not other big city people, but regular folks who we want to be our audience. That's one thing. Another thing is, in order to be an independent filmmaker, in other words, to really pursue the stories that you feel are most important, right? Not to look around, not to think, what kind of movie can I get funded? What should my next film be? What would be a hit? Me and Jim and me and Steve have never, ever thought that way. We look to see what would be a story that would make sense for us to tell and that seemed important. That's another reason I love living here. Just the people around and the fact that you can live inexpensively and have the freedom to do what you think is important to do.
It makes sense that you're here. And and by virtue of that, this arc, it's just remarkable. Mm-hmm. It's Julia Reichert, 50 years in film, an exhibition that begins its presence at the Wexner Center in Columbus. You can find out more, and I hope you will, at wexarts.org. All one word, wexarts.org. Thank you so much for taking the time and talking with
us
today.
Thank you, Nikki. This is fun.
And that's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. thanks to generous listeners like you. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WISO, it's Vic McCunis with The Book Nook.